Welcome to the Agile Wire, brought to you by Wisconsin Agility. We want you to get agile and stay agile. Now here are your hosts, Jeff Bubbles and Chad Beyer.
All right, and we're recording. All right, welcome to the Agile Wire, where we help people get agile and stay agile. We have Jason Little joining us today. Jason, a lot of people probably know you in the agile, you know, space, but for those that don't, like, can you give yourself just a brief background introduction of, you know, some of the highlights from your career?
Sure. So first, thanks for the invite. Thanks for having me. I got started, I started my career as a developer. So some people listening may remember Cold Fusion. So I used to call myself the world's greatest Cold Fusion developer because there was like maybe three of us in the world. But so came from that background in IT, and then I got involved in helping companies with Agile in the early 2000s. So actually, that's a great story from Ellen Gottsdiener. I was chatting with her once, and she said she remembers the very first, you know, the big Agile conference that happens every year. She's like, yeah, it was like 11 of us having breakfast. Like, that was Agile 1 or whatever it was. So it was back in those days when it was, you know, pre-smartphone and kind of hard to connect with people and find good information and stuff. And through the years, worked as a Scrum Master, Product Owner, Tester, Internal Coach, External Coach. And then probably the, I guess, the mid to late 2000s, started getting involved in the organizational change stuff and just thought, well, what if we started to help companies transition to Agile by actually using Agile? It just seemed to make a whole lot of sense. And then so that's basically been the last 15 years or so of my life is focusing on that space. So like take all the good stuff from lean startup and design thinking and throw out the stuff that doesn't make sense and pillage some stuff from the change community and the OD space and just mash everything together to build something in context that works.
That's awesome. So I got to share, let's go back in history a little bit on our first interactions, right? So you probably don't remember me because I was just in the audience, but back in, I'm thinking it was 2015, the company that Jeff and I met at and used to work at in Wisconsin area hosted a conference in the Chicago area. And you were on stage and you got some really good laughs when you did this, but you had this, you're going to remember this presentation, I'm pretty sure. You probably have got some good mileage out of this. So you were like doing this installation of an agile transformation. And so you like had this, you know, classic kind of Windows pop-up, right? That had the progress bar going, and then it gets all the way to the end, and then it's like transformation failed, backing out everything, right? And it killed on stage. Like if there's ever gonna be like an agile stand up comedy like club, you would kill with that bit. Like it was really awesome. So anyway, I remember that. I've told that story to people. I've probably stolen some of the pieces of that over the years, but I don't know, because we're talking about change, maybe that was something, you know, but that was more than 10 years ago now? No, not 10, I guess, but we're getting there, right? Well, almost a decade ago that you probably did that. So you want to like riff on that and give us your thoughts on maybe the connection of that presentation and how it's either changed or stayed the same in the last 8 to 10 years?
Yeah, the funny part about that was I remember that conference well because it was in such a cool venue. It was a really cool space.
Yep.
I did that entire video at like midnight the night before. So, because I think I was on day two.
Yeah, maybe. It's all very fuzzy now, but.
Yeah, but I remember just the idea popped in because I think by that time, I don't know, maybe I'd worked on 10 or 12 Agile transformations and they all kind of had the same. And then all the Spotify stuff came up and one of the companies I was doing some work for, they printed out, you know, the posters and the whole idea of guilds and squads and all these things were starting to become popular, but companies weren't really doing anything. They were just relabeling things. They're like, oh, we're not testers anymore. We're a testing guild. Okay. So, it just seemed to be a pattern. It's people were just, they weren't changing anything about the structure of their organizations, which if you don't change your structure, it it's kind of pointless. It's not really going to change anything. You might make an individual function faster. And I've always been such a huge stand-up comedy fan, so I thought, let's do something and just kind of see if it works. And man, that was stressful. I think I was even like at the side of the stage beforehand. I'm like, oh crap, this button doesn't really work right. Oh, I need a blue screen of death in here at the end. And yeah, so that all came together last minute.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lyric in one of my silly Scrum parody songs called, basically the line goes, in 2001, a manifesto was born and we're all still trying to transform. And I feel like it's very related to that. So I guess from a lean change perspective, from any change perspective, like what is the secret sauce at this point? I feel like we've, between the three of us, we've seen enough transformations, quote unquote, fail or stall or right struggle. So like from your perspective, what's the secret sauce?
I think it's, there's a lot of corporate Me Too-ism. So, you know, 2013-ish, 14-ish, I don't know, maybe you guys, I don't know if you've seen the same, that seemed to be when Agile turned into a big business, like 2014-ish, maybe something like that. And companies were just doing it because everybody else was. So it was just transformation and name only. So I think, I don't know, you guys probably heard the term Agile and name only, or yep. You've seen it like all over the place where it's just, everybody's doing it, we should probably do it too, just in case. And the funny thing about that is I think that is really only true in the enterprise space. It's like, for some reason we take what happens in enterprises as the truth. And you're talking, you know, what, 1% of the global companies around the world? Cause I mean, have you guys worked with any medium or smaller companies that were just completely kicking ass with this stuff, but you don't see any of their stories on LinkedIn. You only see the, look how stupid this big bank is.
Yeah,
I mean, we've
had some startups that we're working with this summer, and like they're doing rocking it, right? Like they're delivering stuff frequently. They're like learning and adapting. Like they don't have these massive roadmaps, or you know, that they're like trying to hit all these, you know, features, and it's just, it was great, and it was funny. We actually had coffee, Chad and I, with somebody in our community who just moved here, and they had worked at like Twitter and I think a couple other tech companies in Silicon Valley. They moved to our area and we were just, you know, got together and had a conversation, and they're like, you know, I don't really know if I'm doing Agile. It's just, this is the way I've always worked. And I'm like, well, tell us what that means. And like, they started describing, like, sounds like that's all you know. Like you've never done it the other way. And so it's kind of interesting where people have come from. And I guess that's maybe when we know things are actually working, is when people are like, I don't even know if this thing is Agile anymore. And you're just like, yeah, it definitely is. Cause you know, we've seen the other side of it. I don't know. So like, what are the greatest, like, what are the common pitfalls you think organizations run into? They're trying to make this leap. They're trying to change where they're coming from. Like, what are the common patterns that you see, Jason?
It's been the same patterns over and over again. You guys have seen the state of Agile, or sorry, the version one state of Agile surveys. So, just for fun, we did a little report on, the first 10 years, which, what are they up to now? 16? 17,
something like that. Yeah, it's in that range, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think, but the funny thing is, now there's 100 more of those. Like, everybody's doing a state of whatever. And I remember looking at theirs, and number one, it was always general resistance to change. Like 50 to 55% of the respondents said Agile failed because of general resistance. 30 to 35%, and this is consistent every year, was failure to change the culture. And then, or either failure to change the culture or the culture is at odds with Agile. And then the third was always something blaming like management. Mm-hmm. And I think those are similar, but more often than not lately, I've been thinking about the change isn't really necessary. You know, like you look at the banks here in Canada have been transforming for 10 years, maybe a little bit longer. When did I start? Yeah, 10-ish, maybe a little bit more. And every 12 to 18 months, it's just a different cycle. You know, like first 3 years for one of the banks was just trying to get people to run Agile projects. So that was their metric, was percentage of projects that have checked the Agile checkbox in our ERP system. Nothing's really different. And then they bring in the next wave of consultants 12 to 18 months later, They go through the same thing, gets a little bit better here and there. And there's some pockets that are really doing well. So it's funny to say on the outside, but I think they're having little successes with it over time. But it's easier to just say, well, it didn't meet what is in my head of what it could have been. Therefore, it failed. Whereas for the company, I mean, look at the banks here. They're making tons of cash. All right. I think I just saw something in my newsfeed. TD has to pay $1.2 billion for something they were sued for. And I'm not on Twitter anymore, but my brain went to, and in other news, TD raises rates by 30 cents per customer. Yeah. And that, you know, it's not like they're going to do a transformation to make sure they stay successful. They're just going to raise prices or they're going to cut staff. Like you've seen in all the big tech companies that are laying off, you know, tens of thousands of people. And I think we forget that, you know, geez, a friend of mine, their whole agile coaching team was let go in an insurance company because that's the first things to go, right?
Yep.
We're not going to meet the quarterly target. Anybody who's not providing direct value, whoosh, and that's usually change people or agile coaches or so. I think we've slowly learned that business runs the way business has always run. And for some companies, agile is just a way to do some things a little bit faster, and they're getting success in pockets, but big transformations, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think when you say, like, Chad and I say this all the time, when companies say, oh, like, do you really need to transform? Like, especially insurance companies, we tend to work with a lot of insurance companies and financial companies that I'm just like, are you sure you want to make this change? Because, you know, what we're talking about is major change. If we really want to do this right, that's going to like totally change your culture. That's going to be a different way of working. They're like, no, we'd like 10 to, you know, 20% increase in like productivity. It's like, I don't know how to do it at a 10 to 20% increase. Like it's kind of got to get to this level, and maybe they have too much money. Like we always say this, like too much money that they don't need to change, like until they're disrupted by something major, you know, inside of their industry.
Yeah. Yeah, the banks have done a really good job here of snuggling up to all the fintechs. Like this is an old stat, but I think there was something like 180 fintech startups just in downtown Toronto a couple of years ago. And they partner with a lot of them. Like they'll work with them, they'll provide them space, like as an incubator. They do these digital factories, digital garages types of things. So they keep them close and they learn from them. And then they either buy them or, you know, they'll partner with them somehow or take some of their ideas somehow. But the system up here is called an oligopoly. So it's the small few control the ecosystem. So it's really you could say the big six, but really the big five. They need to maintain the status quo. They don't need to transform or change. Same with the telecoms up here. They don't need to transform. They just need to maintain the status quo to keep that ecosystem intact. Because, you know, anti-competitive laws, the telecoms here can't really out-compete each other because they just can't. They're not allowed to price undercut and do all these types of things. So I think the change in the transformation is really going to be a matter of industry more than anything else. Sure. I mean, you guys use PayPal, right?
Yep.
Have you been using PayPal forever?
Yep.
Remember when it was really bad?
Yep.
Their transformation story was pretty good, but it was all technical. I mean, the story was they put a stake in the ground and they said everything new from here on out runs agile, whatever that means. Anything that is less than 50% done, transform it. And anything that's more than 50% done, leave it alone and just let it finish. And you can see how much better their services are. Same with Salesforce. I used to be a Salesforce customer back when they were on 18-month release cycles. Yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
And then they went to quarterly and they got, what was it, X-Force? Oh, no, wait, that's Deadpool. they had some Force conference, right?
Yep.
Where they were doing all these plugins and add-ons. And I was a customer through that whole thing. So you got to see the benefit. But the banks, I mean, I still get an email from my bank saying, did you know you can check your balance online? I'm like, I could do that in 1995 with a floppy disk, you know? So it's in the eye of the beholder is the short way of saying it, I guess.
Yeah. All right. I got a place to take the conversation here. So, and let's, maybe we'll try to like shift from the agile word and agile transformation and just talk about change in general. So how... when did your book come out? Like Lean Change Management, how long has it been out now? It's
2012 was the Lean Pub version.
Okay.
So chapter by chapter, and then 2014 the rewrite.
Great. Yep. So we're about a decade into the future.
Yeah.
So Jeff's going to laugh maybe at this part. So we obviously run and attend many Agile meetups in the area, but I also have found it's sort of fun. This was maybe pre-pandemic, but I would go to these change management meetups in our area. And I kind of got a reputation for coming in and kind of like ruffling everyone's feathers. And I would sort of say like, I don't think the change management profession should even be a profession. And then like everybody in there who like, you know, their livelihood is based on change management job titles is like, who is this crazy guy in the beard? Like coming to our meetup and, you know, making us chat, you know, have these questions. So I do think, right, the word management, change management implies controlling the change in my mind. And whenever I've seen big change management efforts, it's like this predetermined, like we're trying to take people a certain way. So what are your thoughts on that? Like, is there a better word now or was there than the phrase change management, like change control, controlling the change?
In traditional change management, I see some of them saying change enablement, but I see that with Agile COEs too.
Sure.
We're not an Agile COE, we're Agile enablement. And they just change the word, but they don't actually change anything about the approach. It's like the Spotify thing, right?
Yep. Yep.
I always use change facilitation.
Yep.
You know, like we don't lead change and we don't manage the change. We're white space workers, is the language I like to use. Like we fill in the cracks and we help build bridges between groups and people and departments, and we help them make sense of their context, and then we help them move forward. And sometimes we might have to take on a coaching stance or a training stance or a mentor stance or even a consultant stance. You're not going to go into a big company as a coach and go, tell me how you feel about that. Like they're going to be like, get the f out, right? So you have to choose the appropriate stance. And I had almost the exact same situation you described. I went to Melbourne, and there was an Agile meetup on the Monday and a change management meetup on the next night. And they were both in the same, like right beside each other in the buildings. So I kind of had each foot in both camps. Does that make sense? For a while. So I'm like, well, let's get all the change people to come to the Agile meetup and let's get all the change people. And it was exactly what you described. They're like, you Agile people, all you do is come in and kick up blah, blah, blah. And then, oh, you change people, you just don't get it. And then at the end of those meetups, it was, we both want the same things. We just express ourselves differently. Like the change people are used to being order takers. Jerry Weinberg calls it dropping change through the hole in the floor. So the leaders, you know, they read an article on Forbes and they go, oh, go get me one of those. And they drop it into the change people and the change people go, okay. And then they go fill the order, right? And people who come from an Agile background are typically the opposite because they've got more, generally speaking, more disruptive questioning attitudes because that's always what Agile has been. So they're like, well, wait a minute, this change doesn't make any sense. So they push back. And so it's two opposite approaches for the most part. I think the communities are getting along a little bit better now, but a lot of the, you know, the old school change management, there's always going to be a need for that in big companies. That's just process driven.
Yep.
So they're more like project managers or guardians of the process as opposed to actually doing meaningful change because some of these companies don't really need to do anything different.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff and I were at an event the other night where we surfaced this very conversation. And then afterwards we had a drink at a local bar and we're kind of chatting about it. And I was kind of questioning like, well, what is a better word than management? So we threw out change engagement, right? I love that you just threw out enablement and then also obviously facilitation. So I think those are great words. Sometimes I can dig in on these things, but I do think if we want the real change to happen in like the job titles and professions that people have, we, like you said, we won't change it until we actually start changing the words. Like words matter, right? So if you have change management in your title, you're going to be thinking, how do I manage the change? You know, when I think about lean change versus the traditional way, you can do whatever you want, right? Like you said, big corps, they're going to do it that way. It's going to, in my opinion, it's going to take them longer to make it happen. And maybe it never will happen. And it'll probably cost more because there's more time. Whereas lean change, you're going to make micro changes. You're going to make a big impact as you go. And it's going to be efficient, effective as it possibly can, right? So, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. To me, it's a no-brainer. But I agree, mm-hmm. there's probably some corps that will just continue on the path of like, yeah, we're just gonna manage the message and try to push it out.
Yeah, it's a matter of how much certainty their stakeholders need. And some need more than others mm-hmm. because change, obviously, it's so contextual. Like project-based change versus transformational change are kind of the two biggies. But the one company, I think I can mention their name, but I won't just in case because I can't remember. They had very long change cycles. So, you know, they wanted to call it change agility. So they wanted to implement change agility. So they called me up and blah, blah, blah. We did some things. And the way they do change is they do like 6 months of like pre-planning, which is the thinkers dream everything up. And then they have like a big process where they throw it over the fence and then they get 6 months to implement it. And this is a Fortune 50 company. So it's, they're not, you know, they're doing pretty good. Yeah. And my whole shtick in that whole thing was really pushing them hard on why do you want to do change differently? You guys crush the market. Why does it matter? And change in that organization is, the people were all great, super smart. We did some pretty fun things there. The challenge they ran into was it's impossible to co-create when you have 6 months to decide all the things you want to do in advance. And there's reasons why they have to do that. So really you're just stuck with implementing, you know, lean change or change agility in the execution phase, which a lot of traditional change managers, that's what they see. They're like, they see it as an execution model. I'm like, well, how do you know you're doing the right change in the first place? Well, because, you know, the order came into the kitchen that said, you know, go do this. Yeah. And we're stuck. You know, we don't have a seat at the table. We can't kick back. And I'm like, sure you can. You just don't feel safe to do it for a variety of reasons. So how do you do that? And I pushed them super hard on, I still don't understand why you want to do this. There's no real reason from senior leadership, and we were pretty high up in the organization, about why you want to change a different way. We did some really awesome pilots where they were just blown away by the real-timeness. And I think that's the pain they wanted to solve, is they saw like change management as a bunch of mosquitoes that were just bugging the crap out of them all the time with, you know, here's the 34-page onboarding deck. So we did a couple of pilots where we did A-B comparison. So we would do, here's the old world. You're going to get this 34-page whatever. New world, it's a canvas and a half-hour conversation. And every week it's a, you know, 30-minute stand-up. Sorry, I guess I'll get my Agile badges taken away for it being 30 minutes. And we update Miro in real time. And they're like, what, that's it? Yeah. Because normally they'd go away for 2 weeks and they would redo the deck, and then they would circulate the deck and make sure they got all the feedback right. And then they schedule a meeting 2 weeks later and they go, yep, we have it. Okay, great. We can now execute. And they lose a month to 6 weeks every time. And now they're doing it in real time. So the execution part they really liked, and nobody in that company liked the change process they were using. They all hated it except for the people who were certified in the other method they were using. They would say things like, our method always worked. They just won't let us use it because they don't like it. It's too much stuff. It's not a bad method. It's just, I think change people, we forget people have day jobs. Like we're thinking about the change 100% of the time and they're never thinking about it. So they want you to be brief, be bold, be gone.
I just want to highlight something I think tactically that you talked about. So you talked about the power of visualization in a conversation instead of like a document that's maybe well-refined, a lot of analysis done on it, and the speed at which you can adjust things there, right? Like, so it's not just change. Like Chad and I use that all the time in our consulting from anything agile, like we're struggling on where we go with this major product. And it's like, bring Canvas, bring conversation, start like talking about it. And with facilitation and a limited period of time, like it's amazing what you can come up with. And I think that that's huge, right? So I just love that, you know, the core essence of what we've been talking about here when thinking about change is like focusing on a feedback mindset versus an analysis mindset. I mean, everything that you talk about all the time kind of goes to that. I think that's everything agile. It's really about that feedback and how do you accelerate that? So I think that's maybe a nudge out there, isn't it, to everybody? Like, think about how you can do a little less analysis and do a little bit more feedback and a little bit more learning.
And know when to wait.
Yeah.
Like they, a month into this engagement, the company did a reorg that was basically in direct conflict with the objective that the change team was given to help this other team with. But the change team still had to push. Well, we've got to put in our status reports. We got to show that we're doing stuff, and we get pushed into this kind of this management mode. And we actually paused for a month. So it took some finagling, but a friend of mine who I worked with once, this is a little dirt road, we were doing a retrospective with a bunch of managers, and just we felt like people were exhausted and they were so sick of this agile stuff. And he wrote on the whiteboard, "What are you tolerating?" I'm like, what an awesome question to ask in a retro. Yeah. And we were hoping they would say, "We're tolerating you." Mm-hmm. And we just had a great conversation, but they were tired. So we just waited for a bit to do other things and reaffirm that we were there to help. So with this company, when they did the reorg, you know, it took some finagling, but we waited. You know, being the outsider, it was easy for me to say, it doesn't sound like this is a good time to keep going with this for these reasons. And it doesn't seem like people want to say it out loud. Am I off the mark or what? And then finally somebody went, yeah, we don't even know if we should keep going down that road. So let's just wait and we'll come back to you in a month. And we just paused the whole thing.
Yeah. But,
you know, you still have to go through the deck and all this stuff and use AI for that. I've been doing a bunch of AI stuff on change comms and it's making some change comms people angry, but you know, you can automate a lot of that stuff. So focus on the interactions and the stuff that matters, which is helping people get unstuck.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, the number of times we've said the phrase change, you know, during any change effort, right? You got to have patience and persistence. A scrum master trying to attack a huge organizational impediment, patience and persistence. And I think what you're describing is like, there's a time component to both of those. Like sometimes patience means I have to like take a pause during a workday. Sometimes patience means we got to take a week to month pause, right? Like, but persistent, you're still going to come back to it, right? I mean, maybe you abandon some things completely, depending on the client situation, but for the most part, yeah, like it's hard work being a change agent. Like a lot, if you're not internally driven by it, it's tough, right? Patience and persistence. You almost need like you need coaches for the coaches or coaches for the change agents to like keep them sane, you know? Like it's always nice to have a sounding board, because it's tough. It's like change is hard, right? It's easy. It's in concept, it's easy. This is all we have to do, but it's messy. So it's hard.
Yeah. You guys know Michael Spade, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I was in a coaching circle with him, I don't know, mid-2000s or so. And there's some transformation that I was working on. We were doing, this is like all the precursor to the lean change stuff. We were just using A3s, quarterly A3 reports. So instead of a change canvas, it was an A3. Mm-hmm. And then we'd identify the data and then we'd work with the leads of each of the departments to get the data, come up with our four things for this quarter and just keep following that process. And I think it was maybe 8 months, 9 months or whatever, 3 quarters into it, or maybe a year into it, I can't remember. So we had our plan of our canvas. And I remember I would always hire him just with my own pocket money, just to get exactly what you described, because we need the feedback too. And I remember it goes, that looks like a lot of fluff and bullshit. And let me tell you why. And I was like, you know what? You're 100% right. It is a bunch of bullshit. And then we actually stripped away a lot of the nonsense and, you know, like got to the stuff that matters. So that outside perspective, it's easy for him to see that, where I can't because I'm in the soup.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, that you bring up Michael Spade. So just a historical shout out too. So I'm sure this has been a story for many people, but long time ago, I attended a coaching class with, it was with Michael Spade and Michael Hammond at the time. And then Lisa, obviously Lisa Atkins taught the other ones. Right. So anyway, I remember like, I'm like the stereotypical, like, man, that 3-day class experience had a huge impact on my life. I was relatively early on in my, I guess, agile coaching consulting transition. And I literally remember after the 3-day course, like, I went up to both those guys and I like gave them a hug and I was just like, this was so great. Right. Like, cause they just, they call things like they are, they're very talented at what they do. And man, like, they helped so many people in that class, like, learn, grow, reflect. Right. So anyway, you're just bringing back all those memories. I don't know if you have similar interactions with them, you know, when you first met them, but I mean, yeah. I don't hug every instructor of courses. Right. Like, they were even like, okay, we're going in for the hug. Like, you know, this was pre-pandemic. So like handshakes and hugs were pretty cool. But anyway, it was a great experience, right? It does really help to have somebody outside of your own brain give you those nudges and feedback, right?
Yeah. There's Jerry Weinberg has a really good book. A lot of my stuff's influenced by Jerry Weinberg and Esther Derby, Steve Smith, Don Gray,
yep,
and Johanna Rothman from PSL and AYE. And now I'm actually in a, every 2 weeks, not really a coaching circle, but like a Satir workshop with Gene McClendon, who was one of the originators of all that stuff with Virginia Satir way back when.
Awesome.
And the book, Are Your Lights On? By Jerry Weinberg is like a heart attack of learning for change agents. Cause he talks exactly about that, you know, the benefit of hiring the non-expert, because they don't know any better and they can ask a real honest, simple question that we've got blinders on for. So
yeah,
you could go to the variety store to buy a bag of chips and you could ask the person behind the counter who's never worked in an office before. They would give you such an insightful answer because they don't know the context at all.
It's funny how, like, I get that this pushback sometimes in organizations when they'll be like, well, how can a scrum master really like work in our industry if they don't understand our tech or our business or whatever else? They really do struggle sometimes when you talk to certain leaders. Like, if you're not the subject matter expert, how do you provide help and guidance for a team? And it's like, I don't know, maybe not everyone's experienced the power of coaching, like peer coaching, you know, where someone can come in, ask you those powerful questions, really make you reflect and, you know, self-discover different answers. Because it's one thing to know an answer. It's another thing to be able to apply it and really truly believe it, you know?
Mm. Yeah. I remember once our coaching team got fired because they didn't have Scrum Master titles in the organization and a new CTO or somebody came in and we had these Scrum Master meetup posters because we just had informal Scrum Masters on the team. They would usually rotate it every 2 weeks. Like the tester would be it this week and whatever. Yeah. And I remember she came in and what's a Scrum Master thing? You know, sees the poster, looks at the org chart, looks back. Wait a minute. There's no Scrum Masters here. Get out. But yeah, we were always working towards trying to make ourselves obsolete and trying to really get the people on the teams to rotate at least the duties of the Scrum Master and stuff like that. I think the only thing I do appreciate is a technical Scrum Master, because I think the art of extreme programming has been lost.
Sure.
You know, if you Googled or went to the Wayback Machine for all the old Agile conferences, they're all technical.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then by 2010, 2011... they called them the process weenies, came in and kind of took over. And all the XP stuff just kind of got lost down the wayside. So we would always, you know, when I was doing deep embedded consulting, we always had a pair, always in every company, no matter what. We wouldn't sell any engagement unless they would agree to paired coaching. And we had, you know, kind of one person who would work in the white space in the organizational layer, and we had one like rock solid technical person that could help with stuff, and then you've got a good 1-2 punch.
Yeah, and you're preaching to the choir there. Like, I mean, Jeff and I basically in our company, like, we come as a pair wherever we go. So there's always it's a luxury, really, right? Like, I feel I sometimes we feel bad for, like, we know we have plenty of colleagues who are also running their own companies, but if they're on their own, right, it's very different. You don't have that other sounding board to bounce all the complexity of any change effort, right, as you're into it. So
yeah, and the market's changing so much too with coaching. I'm finding a lot of companies, they want employees. And I should say enterprise companies, you know, like they've been paying the Accentures and the Deloittes
sure.
tens of millions of dollars for years. And they would much rather have their employees. And then, you know, these, you know, when I was at the heyday, you know, when you can charge $3,500 to $5,500 a day rate, and now they want you to be an employee, and that drops to, you know, $100 an hour that they're willing to pay. To have their own contractors or an employee, you know, pretty big shift in the market.
Yeah. And, you know, that's also what we just came from earlier, right? Like having that completely independent outside perspective on something. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Because I feel like I say the phrase all the time, like it's much harder to be an internal change agent than it is an external change agent. And that's not original thoughts, right? This has been written about in literature for years and years. Like, you can't be a prophet in your own land, like that, all the sayings, right? So I mean,
yeah,
what are your thoughts, like as those organizations are shifting to that, aren't they just setting themselves up for even just a longer, slower process to change potentially?
I think the people end up becoming just process pushers more than anything else, because that's, you know, you've always got to be doing something, and you've always got your objectives in your department that you have to live up to. I used to have a good joke about whenever we run into problems in the organizations, we create another stack of hierarchy for it. So now when you do a project liftoff, you've got somebody from the process improvement team, somebody from the agile COE, somebody from the innovation COE, somebody from the design thinking COE, somebody from the customer experience COE, and you've got 400 people in a project liftoff and half a developer.
Yep.
And you just become another, you get pulled into the system. The pattern here is interesting with the banks and the telecoms, because all the coaches I know, they just move on, right? They'll be at TELUS for a while, then they'll be like, yeah, screw this. And then they go over to Rogers, then they go to Bell, and then they just circulate through all the telecoms and through all the banks and stuff like that. And now I think most are with RBC. RBC is basically, you know, they put a vacuum over the city and they just grabbed anybody, agile anything, and brought them in there. Like everybody I know is working with RBC right now, all across the board. And they have the same problems as everybody else. Right? They've got a COE where their stand-up is an hour long. And this is agile people, because they're pulled into the system just like everybody else. Yeah. They're just a stuck. They've got to do their TPS reports. They've got to do their blah, 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 and all this type of stuff. And if you don't have that outside voice, you can't play good cop, bad cop. You need somebody that can say things that you can't get away with.
Yeah.
And that's, it depends on the attitude. I mean, you know, what kind of stance do you guys take when you go in? Is it you're not there to be their friend, right? You're there to help, and sometimes they need the hard truth.
Yep.
But like in everything, like, you know, you have to be respectful and you have to be professional in the way that you do it. You know, like if you mm-hmm. come in very abrasively, like that, it's not going to be received well, and you're not going to do anything for the change. And so mm-hmm. I think, like, as an external person, you knowing and them knowing, like, yeah, they can fire us today and we can never be back here again. That's okay. Like, we kind of have that relationship, and I can tell you stuff, but I also have other clients. So like, if you want to end, we can end, but I'm going to tell you the honest truth, like a friend would. Like, I'm just going to give it to you straight. I have no stake in whether you choose to take or not take this advice that I'm going to give you, but this is what I'm seeing. Right. And I think when you can get it, you know, people are talking about their household incomes, and it's just like they feel afraid that, like, if I say the truth or I push for this change and it doesn't go well, then I lose my job. Some people really struggle with that. I think Chad and I, like, we've learned, like, we can't be that person. Like, we're just going to say what we're going to say. Like, we can't, we don't do well with that. So being in consulting is a good fit for us. But I think that that happens to a lot of internal change agents. They need someone like us to come in and say those things, even though they've been thinking them and saying it maybe in a different way, to help reveal what's going on inside of the system.
It's really Jeff, I'm pretty sure it comes straight from Patrick Lencioni's book. I mean, like, we were both heavily influenced by some of the books that Patrick Lencioni wrote. The one I'm thinking of is Getting Naked, which, you know, the title, for anyone who hasn't heard of that book now, like, and this is the first time you're hearing about it, I guess context matters there. Like, it's an odd title for a book, but it's all about how to bring your authentic self. I'll just try to summarize the whole thing to a consulting stance and engagement. So I'm pretty sure the phrase kind truth, which we use all the time, is coming straight from that. Yep. Yeah, and we live and breathe that with our clients. Like, we show up, we just start providing advice, like, immediately. We don't even think of it as a sales conversation. We're just like, cool, let's just start working together, providing advice, tell you the kind truth. And it just kind of grows from there. And eventually, if there's a fit, then clients start paying us money. Like, that's, I'm summarizing it, but that's kind of how we operate. So I think the key to keep in mind about kind truth, right? Hopefully the word kind conveys it enough, but you can't just come in so crazy for the change. And I think this is maybe for some scrum masters, if you're listening, like, we've had people come to us before and say, hey, I tried voicing that, my opinion on that, and I got fired. And some people I've probably been guilty of in the past have said, like, well, a great scrum master is willing to get fired. Well, I don't know. I don't know if that's actually true. I think you can approach change from a respectful and professional stance, but also be kind truth, patient, persistent, empathetic, right? Like, and that's what, I don't know, that's like what the struggle is for being a change agent. Like, it's not easy. It's like a balancing act all the time of like a little bit of pressure and then, okay, let's see what happens. Yeah. And then a little bit more pressure. So I don't know. What do you think, Jason?
Yeah. One of the companies, they did a split test. One of the enterprise companies up here did a split test with two consulting groups. One was ours and one was another gigantic firm. And our stance was exactly what you described. It's a balance of push and pull. So no one to push, no one to pull back. And we are all influenced by Getting Naked. So take the bullet for the client, tell the kind truth, right?
Yep.
The funny thing is what you described about going in and just working and not worrying about the thing, you know, the contract or selling yourselves. They said, you're the only people who came in and didn't just start talking about yourselves, which they appreciated. Yep. But this company, they did a split test, and the other company, big companies have this problem, right? Oh, great. We got a 6-month contract for 10 people. We don't have anybody on the bench. And they just go out on the street and they're like, hey, you know, they ring the bell. Anybody need a job? So, it's a horrible way to say it, but they just don't get the right experienced people.
Yep.
So they had a situation where a team was struggling with something, and the only thing the scrum master kept coming back with was, I won't let you do it that way because that's not agile. That's not how scrum works. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. And this company was they didn't appreciate that. So they were gone in a week. They canceled the contract and gave the rest of it to us. Because we just came in with a different, you know, we're here to help and help you solve problems. We know we're there to help you solve problems. Nobody wants to implement Agile. Something ain't right. They don't know exactly what it is. They're hoping they can find out, and they're hoping you can help them figure it out and then maybe solve some things. That's what they want. They want problem solvers. They don't want Agile coaches. They don't want Scrum Masters. And I think it's hard. It's hard unless you've been, you know, a leader in a company. You know, if you've been a VP in a company, and I don't mean, you know, I'm the VP of a one-person consulting company, right? If you haven't run your own company and you haven't had to worry about employees and market fit and all that stuff, it's very difficult to empathize with what these folks want. There's just something that ain't right and they can't figure it out. They don't want to go agile. They don't want to do all this stuff. And you have to have enough experience, I think, to know what they want.
Yeah.
Yeah. We say that stuff all the time, right? Like that order mentality, you can try to fake it when you don't have it, but like, man, nothing replaces it until when you have it. So I don't know. It's just that's a life skill or a life experience that if you have it, it's an amazing thing. It changes you forever.
Yeah.
and it really can help you in a lot of things. But I know you asked me before, Jason, like what stances do we put in? And we kind of gave you some examples of some coaching stances and advising stances and teaching stances. But like, what stances do you take in your engagements with clients as like an external change agent?
I usually default to, if I had to pick one, it would be coach, I would guess, but not coach in the classical sense. I would say it would be a mix of coach, mentor, advisor.
Okay.
But it's always just a conversational stance, to overly simplify. Usually why this changed, why now is what kicks off everything.
Yeah.
So you've reached out to me for a reason. So why do you want to do this thing? And why now? Why not a year ago? Why not a year from now? So then that really usually gets them into the, you know, market conditions or whatever is the trigger that's causing them to want to do something differently. And then usually very quickly find out if I'm the right person or if I've got to refer them somewhere else or if we get started. And then, I mean, there's so many branches to the mind map, yeah. Right? One big insurance company, I pushed them really hard in that conversation because it just felt like they weren't even remotely ready, right? They were just talking about how do we create a process model for this team to do this. And I pushed them really, really hard on that with how many times have you done this over the last 2 decades? How many times have you created a new project management method or a new process or you did this and how did it work out? Which I guess they felt was kind of a tacky. So they did, and I was like, great, because this is an environment that I would be able to help in. If you just want to improve process, go for it. Like hire a PMI process person. They're awesome at that. There's no shame in it. We seem to shame them in the Agile community. You can't just do this. Maybe that's the best some companies will do. And why would you care? Go somewhere else where it's funner.
Yeah. Right?
Where you're going to have a better time and, you know, you're going to work on some cool projects and yeah.
Yeah. Do you find like when you ask that question, why change now? Like you come back to that in engagements, like, especially when like, I can imagine when there's a dilemma or a very tough conversation you have to have about, do we go this direction or that direction? Like that could be really useful.
Yeah. There's that anchor is always there. So usually that conversation makes its way onto a canvas at some point and it just gets stuffed in a drawer. And then at X cadence, maybe that's a month, maybe that's 3 months, whenever it makes sense, bring it back out. Here's what we thought ahead of time. What do we think now? Videos work really well. I was in somewhere, Illinois, where the hell was it? I can't remember. Somewhere in the Midwest. And a big logistics company, and we actually had them do videos. So we had like 60 managers in the room and we did some cool like lean coffee sessions and aggregated lean coffees, and we tried to whittle it down to what was the number one thing that they wanted to work on. And then I did a remember the future kind of exercise, and I said, so if you're at the water cooler 3 months from now talking about whatever it is that we did, just act it out. 2 minutes, act it out, we'll videotape it. And then a month from now, I want all y'all to sit in there and just watch those videos and go, are we headed towards that future? Why or why not? And if you can just keep doing that, because it's all about problem solving, right? That's feedback driven. You'll figure it out. You'll be able to solve anything, but don't worry about, you know, we want to increase customer engagement from X to Y, because you will. You'll just game the metrics. So make it conversational based and, you know, they were great. I mean, when I walked in, they had they would do hackathons, but they had a huge wall that was painted with Hulk Hogan. What they called it, like Hulkathons or something like that. So they had like a championship belt that they would give to the teams and stuff. I'm like, you guys are going to be fine. You don't even need me, but I'm staying because this looks pretty cool. You guys look like you have a pretty awesome company.
That's awesome. I got to go back to your question that you said you start a lot. You know, whether that's an engagement you're starting or whether it's just you're speaking with the decision maker. I love your follow-up, why now? Like, why this change? That's hard to answer sometimes, right? You'd be surprised, right? Like how hard it is for somebody to articulate why they want to change, right? And then on top, yeah. and then like if they get there, then you're like, and why now? And then they're just like mind blown, right? Like, oh, why now? Like, and there's probably, maybe that one's easier to answer, but it's, I like it because it's just that it's a little bit more to kind of surface what's going on here. Like, what's the driver for this change? The why this change is probably kind of visionary, aspirational, and then the why now is going to probably surface the pressure, the catalyst that they even picked up the phone or, you know, sent an email to talk to you. So I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
That combo question is probably very powerful. No pun intended.
You could follow it up with, and what would happen if we did nothing?
Yeah, sure. There you go. The do nothing option is always a great conversation.
Yeah, because that starts to push into some of the HR things.
Yep.
Because now you see the looks, you're like, oh shit, this is on my performance scorecard. Like, that's why we're doing it now. And if we did nothing, I'm not going to get my bonus or whatever it is. So, and sometimes you can, have you guys had those conversations where you know that's behind it and you can just see the eyes and they're just, please God, don't talk about this.
Yeah. I mean, I think we always try to remind ourselves, like, if an organization's reaching out to us, they likely don't have it all figured out. You know, like, this is something I think you hear kind of new scrum masters, they'll complain so much. Like, they'll come to you and they'll be like, maybe they're looking in between jobs and they're like, I'm looking for a really amazing agile company. It's like, but they don't need you. You need to go in to the messed up company because that's who needs you. And it's the same with us. Like, if they had it all figured out, they wouldn't be talking to us. And I think it's hard for Jeff and I mean, I don't know, Jeff, you can not agree with me here, but it's a constant battle for me because you just have to remember, like, yes, this is, there's incentives at play here. There's other cultural, structural things going on. And if they had it all figured out, they wouldn't be talking to us. So I don't know. You kind of have to coach yourself, like, back to that empathetic stance and being patient with, you know, with everybody. It's 2023 and there are still companies discovering Scrum and Agile for the first time. Like, I know some people don't think that's reality, but it's that's reality. Like, we didn't figure this out a decade ago. It's an ongoing struggle.
Yeah. That whole adoption curve, right? The late majority thinks they're the innovators.
Yep.
Because they're now in the headspace, of what the innovators were doing in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Or geez, even, well, I mean, Esther and Johanna and those folks, they talk about Agile, you know, in the 70s. Jerry Weinberg wrote about this stuff in the 60s.
Yep.
So it's I think that's why the Australians call it ways of working, because they're so sick of the A word. So they basically just rebranded everything to new ways of working. Sorry, that was more British than Australian. I can't do it. I just watched the Jim Jefferies special. You think I'd be able to get the Australian accent?
Oh, nice.
But they had to change it to new ways of working because people were just so fed up with Agile. But it's all the same things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think that a lot of times we don't change those structures like you were talking about earlier in the podcast. And then, you know, the change people leave or coaches leave or whatever, the new leader comes in. And then because the structures are the same as they always were, everybody just reverts back to those old behaviors. They know that. And then just, and so when we come back in, let's just say that somebody's gone down a path and it was 5 years ago, then they reverted back. And then we come in and they're like, I think we did something like this, but I don't know. It's kind of new again, like a lot of new people. And so, like, it seems like a lot of organizations go through these attempts multiple times before they really realize, like, that to make a change, you got to make a change. Like, you know, you got to change something in the structure. And, you know, most of the things that happen in an organization happen because of, you know, the current structure in place. Like, is it Deming? That's it. Like 95% of the problems inside of organizations happen because of the system, not because of the people making certain choices or whatever. So if we believe that to be true, then like everything's about the structure. And so we should be changing the structure so people behave in the way we want them to behave, if that's whatever that means in your context.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the waves of change concept. So stole Herbert Bloomer's ideas behind social movements. This was, a lot of the speaking and workshops around the world the last 10, 12 years was going to companies and finding out why they were getting stuck, what was getting them unstuck. And the waves of change was kind of born out of that. Mm-hmm. It's exactly what you describe. Is the first wave is, you know, in medium and enterprise companies, it's process adoption. We wanted to run one pilot with a Scrum team. And it doesn't work because we don't change the structures around them, but we learn a little bit. And then the next wave with the next group of consultants is they bring in a different process model. And eventually you get down to the point where it becomes about people, but it's, you know, the social movement part is, you know, he talks about emergence. Somebody's upset with the status quo, they take action and things start to emerge. The mistake we make with transformations is we want that to be certain. So we create a scorecard, we create the metrics, we create the comms plan, we create all this static stuff that we can't possibly know, and we hold people to account to those unknowable unknowns. And then we get to coalescence, which is, seems like things are getting off the rails. We should probably get a little more organized. And then you can take that too far into bureaucratization, where you apply the old cultural values to the new culture that you want to see, and you end up in decline. So that's the wave, right? So, you know, we start to run some pilots. It's not as successful as we want. It's because we've got a coach who's running things and we need to get an iron fist ruler in there to create the defined process and push it on people and check the checkboxes for training, which is our old values. And then we co-opt into, we're just doing the same things that we've always done. Mm-hmm. And then we get super frustrated and we go, well, screw those guys. They're out. Get the next consulting people in here, or get rid of the VP of Agile, get somebody new. And you go up the wave again, starts to emerge, gets into coalescence. So in those waves, it's perpetual, just goes on forever. That's how companies work.
Yep. All right. Well, with that, maybe dark summary, I want to shift to something fun maybe as we wrap up here. So you got some guitars in your background. For
yep.
people watching on video, you've seen them the whole episode. Anyone listening, there's guitars on Jason's wall. I have a guitar over to my right here. I've been on a tear to become like the Weird Al Yankovic of the Scrum and Agile parody song community. And all thanks to Jeff, because he just pushes me outside my comfort zone. And he's like, you got to start posting those things on YouTube. So here I am. I'm doing it now. But, you know, you mentioned the Jim Jefferies comedy special. I think that was on Netflix, right?
His new one just came out a few weeks ago.
I actually just watched it too. But like, I've always had this vision, right? The word agile has become ubiquitous enough around the world now, where I feel like someday there's enough people who would find humor in all the things that happen during an agile quote unquote transformation, right? Agile consulting, like there's just so much humor. I mean, when I think back to all the teams that I've interacted with in doing this for over a decade, it's like, my goodness, there's just so much humor. So I've told Jeff this before, right? Like a vision for like a Netflix special, similar to like Silicon Valley, that humor, but like, you know, it's like agile something, right? Like, thoughts? Like, would you watch that on Netflix?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That'd be hilarious. It'd be just like The Office.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So anyway, I know we're all still in like a niche community. Like if I talk to people, you know, at my kid's school and they're like, what do you do? And I say the word agile, they're like, what's that? Like, so I totally understand that it's not that mainstream, but there's so many people around the world doing something with Scrum or Kanban or Agile that I think there's a huge opportunity. But that's a long-winded way to say, also, what are you doing with your guitars? Like, so are you in a band or do you just play or?
Yeah, a little of both. I should have put this beauty up. This was the latest acquisition.
Ooh.
Wow.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
I was in the market for a Strati style.
That's awesome.
And nobody carries, it's a Sire.
Okay.
Which, I watched a couple of reviews and people were just like, for cheaper than a Fender, it's better quality. Sounds just as good. And it's better playability, better attention to detail. But I had to make a road trip to grab that one. And it's a little of both. So I produce music at home. Cool. As well. That's, you know, that's why all the stuff is in here.
Yep.
The drums are out there and write and perform. So my band, we're on a bit of We had a show booked the day everything shut down when COVID happened, and then we all just kind of did some recording instead, and we haven't played there, but yeah, my own stuff.
Yeah.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah, through COVID, I was writing and releasing songs every month, so from scratch.
Yeah.
It's all original stuff, so that's what I use it for. Yeah.
That's so cool. It's my creative outlet, so I get a lot of joy out of just picking up a guitar and wailing away and singing lyrics into the unknown. So
yeah.
So awesome. So okay. Jeff, anything else wrapping up?
I think, you know, this is probably a good spot to wrap up. I mean, Jason, is there anything you want to plug to our listeners before we kind of wrap things up here?
I'm never good at this stuff. Go to leanchange.org if you want to learn anything about any of these ideas. We've got 40 trainers around the world doing workshops constantly. Actually, I just started doing a new workshop on experimentation. So instead of it being like a workshop where people come in and just get trained on stuff, mm-hmm. it's bring your problem, very small groups. Like I try to keep it a max of 6 people in a cohort. And it's basically like a 5-week coaching circle where you bring your problem and we'll get you to an experiment. And then you come back and you tell us how that experiment worked out. So I found people more likely, they don't want to just sit in a training course anymore. I think this whole mm-hmm. 2-day, 3-day class stuff is for change people. They just want an intervention, something intervention style. They need an outside perspective. So these are just like short little bursts of bring your problem, we'll help you figure something out. But realize that the problem you're solving, you're not actually solving it. You're just hopefully creating a bunch of little smaller ones that are easier to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Awesome. We'll put links to that in the show notes. And yeah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks,
yeah,
Jason.
Thanks for having me.
If you found value in today's episode, share this with a friend. Until next time, get agile and stay agile.